And on the phone with us with a look at the backcountry, Greg Gagne with the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Morning, Greg.
Good morning, Leslie. Beautiful mountain morning. Temperatures single digits. A few of the warmer stations are in the low teens. Winds are out of the south, southeast, generally light, averaging less than 10 miles an hour, but gusting in the teens at the upper elevations. Overnight, or since yesterday afternoon and overnight, 2 to 4 inches of snow has fallen on the Salt Lake and Park City Mountains. Cold temperatures and generally cloudy weather this past week has preserved excellent riding conditions on almost all aspects, with only a thin crust on southerly aspects. It's been pretty quiet the past few days in terms of avalanche activity. The only activity we heard yesterday included a few small pockets of sensitive fresh wind drifts on northerly aspects. We had some south winds pick up yesterday afternoon and created a few of these smaller drifts. There also was some sloughing in the top few inches of the surface snow. The surface snow over the past couple of days has grown a bit weaker as well, so we're getting some sloughing. Otherwise, it's been pretty quiet. So primary avalanche problems we're looking at, there's a moderate hazard in isolated terrain for triggering a persistent slab avalanche. This could break down 1 to 3 feet into older snow. This isolated terrain is on slopes facing north through east above 9,000 feet. I think areas such as the Park City Ridgeline is precisely the type of terrain where these avalanches could occur, so generally thinner snowpack regions. Otherwise, for today, two concerns. Any storm snow will slough easily on steeper slopes, especially those facing northwest through east where the existing snow surface is pretty weak. These sloughs will be small, but be aware of any of them carrying you over rocks or accumulating in a steeper terrain trap. For those that are comfortable doing so, a ski cut at the top of a steeper slope is a pretty effective tool at mitigating this hazard. And although the winds are forecasted to remain generally light, any increase in wind speeds today will quickly create pockets of sensitive wind drifts at the upper elevations. I also think the sloughing on the storm snow and any of these fresh wind drifts will easily run on any slick crust on southerly aspects. Beautiful stretch of weather ahead of us coming. Cold northwest flow. So south winds this morning are going to be shifting to the northwest early this afternoon. They should remain generally light. 4 to 8 inches of low-density snow is forecasted during the day today, with a period of heaviest snowfall during the afternoon as the flow shifts to the northwest. Temperatures aren't going to rise much today, remaining in the single digits to low teens. Bit of a break overnight and into tomorrow morning, but another quick hitter tomorrow night.
Okay. Hey, Greg, thanks so much. Well, as the 2018 Olympic Winter Games wind down in Pyeongchang, South Korea, the efforts of bringing back the Winter Games to Utah will start to ramp up. In the studio with a look at the work ahead, I have Colin Hilton. He's a member of the State Olympic Exploration Committee and director of the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Just briefly, I mean, what have you heard about these Winter Games based on the stands? It doesn't look like anything we saw in Salt Lake back in 2002.
My heart kind of goes out to the athletes because, you know, and it reminds me of how much energy we had in our games here in 2002 with, you know, over 20,000 people watching the events. And so I feel for the athletes because, you know, that's what really energizes them for their making great performances. So that's, yes, quite surprising, but I think, reflective of the fact that these mountain venues are 2 hours outside of, you know, Seoul in the major metropolitan area. And it just reminds me of how compact nature Utah is and how opportunistic we would be to host again by having a major city and a very energetic population that really supports watching these winter events.
Yeah, we've talked before how Utah is actually one of the, I think, the largest audience for NBC.
It is, and already the reports in Salt Lake and Utah market is number one in the country watching these games.
So without people there in South Korea, does that mean that they lose money?
I'm not sure the ticket revenue was their major revenue source. Most of that comes from broadcast, but you never know the end results, especially in a big event like that.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big broadcast, of course, and tickets that provided the legacy funding that you operate out with now.
Yes, absolutely. And, this recent effort is, looking at exploring about bringing back the games to a place that really embraces them.
Yeah. So where are we in the process? I mean, have we even decided what year we will bid on?
Yes. And that, you know, this process started last November. It was a pretty intense 3-month effort that pulled in, you know, political, community, sport members to this effort. And we wanted to check in with each of the communities to ensure and explain what has changed since hosting in 2002 and not make an assumption that everybody was gung-ho for it. So it's been a 3-month process and really dug into a lot of particular details.
So what year are we going to bid on?
The year is focused on 2030. And for many of us, we wish it was a little bit sooner. But there is a dynamic with Los Angeles hosting in 2028 for a Summer Olympics that kind of drives the focus to 2030. We leave out a little bit of caveat that if the world can't find a host for 2026, we kind of are a contingency plan for the IOC. And that is a genuine concern for the Olympic movement right now of having enough interested cities.
Hmm. So at one point we had heard that both Denver and Reno would be interested in hosting the games. Would those be the competitors to Salt Lake not getting it?
Within Utah or within the U.S., yes. They have expressed their interest, and the USOC you know, has to walk a little bit of a political process to entertain the interest from multiple cities within the U.S. And you know, we've kind of taken an approach as we welcome that comparison. We welcome a comparison of cities that don't have existing infrastructure versus a city in a region that absolutely has that and are using it very, very much.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're talking something 12 years away. I mean, is this too soon to even be doing this?
No, because much like the Paris and LA dual award of 2 games in a row kind of set a new precedent for the International Olympic Committee to potentially award 2 games at the same time. So in September of 2019 in Milan, Italy, there will be a selection of the 2026 city. And right now, the IOC is not yet determined whether they would potentially do a dual award. And for that reason, we are saying we need to be at the table right now. And even though our focus is 2030, we would essentially have about a year and a half to position Utah to be selected for 2030.
Okay. So what needs to happen between now and then? I mean, do you have to have a complete bid package?
So right now, the IOC is in what they call a dialogue phase. They have kind of changed the rules of bidding to be more informal and more of a dialogue up until this October. And on paper, the USOC needs to select a U.S. city by March 31st. And so right now, the ball is in the court of the U.S. Olympic Committee on whether they are going to name Salt Lake and Utah as their potential candidate city and to enter into this dialogue phase. There's a chance they might have the IOC allow multiple U.S. cities to remain in this dialogue phase, and we actually think that's a good idea because it'll give time for the USOC to have a process to pick a U.S. city. So that will occur through this summer, and yes, we might be vying against Denver and Tahoe region. And then by October, there has to be a selection of one city from the U.S.
Okay. So where does USOC meet then in March?
The USOC doesn't have right now a planned meeting. They're obviously over in Korea. Their focus is on that, and they've got some other challenges with all of the backlash of this gymnastics issue going on. So they'll we're waiting for them to get back and to understand that we've put a stake in the ground and said we're interested, and Utah, we think, would be a perfect candidate city for 2030.
How would the 2030 games differ from the 2002 games?
There would be much more events now. The dynamic in 02, there's about 25% more events to stage the game. So there's not an increase in the number of venues, just more event days at the existing venues that we used in 2002. We would have a focus on more advanced transportation systems that don't rely on park and ride lots as much as we do in more buses and transportation systems that will be developed between now and a future games. We'll have a lot more focus on increased technology advances and perhaps a little bit smaller venues than we did in 2002. But those are too early right now to determine all the specific changes.
Yeah. So looking at what we had here in the Park City area, right, we had the half pipe and the freestyle and the technical events, the GS and the slalom. Would those remain here?
Too early to say. We've kind of talked with each of the venue operators, and we did not get to the level of detail of what sport discipline is actually going to be at each venue. But with increase of events like slopestyle and big air competitions, there are some natural sites that are doing those for the upcoming 2019 World Championships, and we would probably mirror those venues that are continuing to host World Cups and events like that.
Right, and that includes Solitude as part of the World Championships. And so that was off limits back in 2002. Would that mean that that could happen?
We haven't ruled out that as a possibility. There is more, though, still a focus on going to the existing venue operators and having those added disciplines within the venues that we used in 2002.
Yeah. And GS was held, of course, at Park City. That apparently was not on the map that you submitted to someone.
Yes, I know the local paper highlighted that without actually asking any questions of our committee members about that. That is basically just more a reflection of the fact that the increased new events of slopestyle and big air have been happening at Park City, and we can't likely do every one of those disciplines that we did in the Alpine events at three different locations. So it's not ruled out. We actually think that could be a possible location for Alpine, but Deer Valley and Snow Basin, as previous hosts, are the more likely options.
All right. So at this point, we're the only one that we would maybe consider is Solitude as an additional venue site?
You know, right now, we didn't go down that path, and we haven't advanced any discussions. And that one's a political hot potato, and for which we're going to kind of avoid that option at this point.
So through the Legacy Foundation, you've maintained the Olympic speed skating oval, the Nordic skiing course there at Soldier Hollow, the Utah Olympic Park with the bobsled skeleton tracks. What else would be needed?
Nothing. That is the beauty of our positioning to say we have existing infrastructure and we don't plan on building any more. And the key need for me, as you know, on another tract, is maintaining these existing facilities and keeping them at current day standards for how sports need to be held for competitions and training athletes. And that's really what our foundation's focused on over the next, you know, 10 to 12 year period, is making sure we have the appropriate funding to be able to maintain and operate these facilities.
Yeah. Would we need to bond again? And that would be maybe just for some other training facilities, more ice, I think, in particular?
There, again, would not be a need other than to have funding to maintain the existing facilities. So there is would be no plans to build any new venues.
Okay. So at what point do you go all out and say, this is what we do?
You know, I think by putting out this report, and again, it's on our website at UtahOlympicLegacy.org if anybody wants to read a 140-page report on this. But, you know, I think through this statement of putting out this exploratory report, we are saying Utah is ready to do this when the U.S. Olympic Committee and the rest of the world wants to come back to a place that celebrates winter sport. We are passionate about it. The public and political and community support is all there. And we view we could do it and showcase a more sustainable approach to putting on a games without it being a big burden, especially financially, to the local region.
Okay. So stay tuned for end of March, huh?
Yeah, stay tuned, and we'll follow the U.S. Olympic Committee's lead on process steps coming up.
Okay, real quick, the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation has kind of taken the Park City Ski and Snowboard team under its Wings, how has that worked out for you?
Yes, so we're kind of providing the back-end administrative support to what Jesse Hunt and the enormous team of coaches and athletes that are under this. We feel it's like anything. It's going to have its coming together challenges, but the effort so far, I think, has been really wonderful. And I think the benefits of having a set of programs where kids can bounce between the different disciplines is really wonderful. And so far, I think everything is going great. And we need to support these programs. We need to fundraise and do a lot of efforts to get behind them, because that is a story that really helps our positioning efforts to showcase that we love to host winter sports in Utah.
Okay, anything else you want to mention, Colin?
You know, we are growing ourselves. We're going to be introducing some new public activities this summer, a new zip tour program to increase public activity uses. And we hope to get under construction on a new athlete and workforce housing building up at the Olympic Park. So about 180 beds for athletes, both on the long-term and short-term visitations, and for our workforce at the park. So we're excited to get underway on that. We're hoping to break ground this spring.
Yeah, you, just like everyone else, is it challenging to find staff because of the housing?
Absolutely. And like the resorts, we've even supplemented with a J-1 visa student workforce from around the world. They have been terrific, but the housing is the big challenge. So we are taking upon approach that says we are going to build that on property. It's going to support our athletes who need to come and have an affordable place, and to support our employees and our workforce that we value so much in delivering a great experience.
Yeah. Can you get any kind of federal housing grants at all?
It's complicated. Right now we're asking the county to help with conduit tax-free municipal financing, and we have that as a topic next week.
Yeah. What about the USOC?
They are supporting us in many ways, supporting dollars to train the national team athletes. And yes, they are helping with funding of an expansion of the Olympic Oval, a new permanent home for U.S. speed skating down there. So we're under construction on a $12 million project there. And with some funding we expect in this next legislative session, we're going to advance about $10 million worth of capital improvements this next year across the three venues. So that is exciting for our staff that's been kind of holding things together with Band-Aids up to this point.
Okay. Hey, Colin, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, Leslie.
Well, as Project ABC finishes up its planning phase, three open houses are scheduled throughout Summit County to share the findings with county residents. In the studio with details, I have the director of the Park City Summit County Arts Council, Hadley Dynack. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So just start, if you would, by giving us the brief backstory to how we got to this point.
Sure. Well, Project ABC, which stands for Art, Beauty, and Culture, is a community-wide cultural planning project. It launched publicly last May, and we spent the summer really doing a lot of data collection, asking residents, having interviews with community leaders, holding a lot of meetings and convenings to really understand what the hopes, dreams, needs, challenges for the future of arts and culture are here in Summit County. The purpose of this event, the event is coming up with these open houses. The purpose of this cultural planning project is really to chart a roadmap for the future of arts and culture in Summit County over many years to come.
Okay. So how many people have you had participate in this survey?
So 1,000 people, or nearly 1,000 people, I think the number was like 978, completed the survey. The vast majority of them were Summit County residents, although we did capture some visitors to our community as well. We interviewed about 40 different people from different organizations and groups around Summit County, and then had dozens of convenings. So I would say a couple thousand people have really engaged at this point. We spent the fall really pulling together what we heard from the different stakeholder groups, and we looked at the idea that we don't really want to plan in silos, but we want to look across the community to create strategies and recommendations. So we've got 7 different priorities that have come up and about 48 specific strategies, and the open houses are really a way to come back and share those findings with the larger community. They were workshopped last November at the Project ABC Summit, and so we have already gotten a lot of input on the strategies, but we really want to create another opportunity for people to engage.
So do you feel like you have a good cross-section then of Summit County here?
We really do, yeah. Both Park City, the west side, the basin, as well as east side residents have participated. We've really made an effort to go to the city councils on the east side to meet with them. And two of these open houses will be held on the east side, one in North Summit that's on Tuesday at the Colville Library from 5 to 7, and then one on March 6th in South Summit, hopefully at the new South Summit Services Building, if that's ready for occupancy. And if not, we'll hold it at the Camas Town Hall.
All right. And then the Park City meeting will be Thursday, the 8th from 5 to 7 at the library.
Correct.
As well.
Yep.
Okay. So talk to me a little bit about the priorities. Can you outline those for me?
Yeah, I think it's really great opportunity for people to go onto the Project ABC website. The URL for that is projectabcsc.com, and the SC stands for Summit County, so projectabcsc.com. And if you go to the progress page, it's really the clearinghouse for all information. We have all the decks that were used at different meetings, the findings from the summit, and then there's a button that says draft recommendations and strategies, and that's really the place to go to read them in detail. We'll also have a summary of all of these findings at the open houses.
Okay, but I mean, are they just seven different ones, or are they prioritized?
Yeah, well, they're really big buckets, we're calling them, of collective priorities. So they're things about spaces, which are actually facilities and venues for arts and culture in Summit County, and places, which are geographies where arts and culture happen, how we can develop them authentically to the place that they exist, how we can connect them together, how we can use public art as a strategy to tell the story of our community. There's a big section on data, which is really documenting the impact of arts and culture on our community. We don't have a lot of good data right now to document that. A lot of different organizations do it, but we're interested in pulling something collectively together. We've started that through this process, but we're recommending that we create some systems and structures to do that better. There's, of course, a funding section because we can't do this work without funding. And then a section on the people that are doing arts and culture in the community, the artists, the creative entrepreneurs, how we can support them and create opportunities for them to work together and build their businesses. And then the programming that we offer, particularly arts education and how we are engaging our young people.
Okay. So what happens then after March 8th?
So that's a great question. I think one of the things about this project that is both a strength and a weakness is it's a community-driven, collaborative one. So the Arts Council is managing the process, which, as you mentioned, is nearing its completion. There's no real accountability holder to oversee all of it at this point. I think governance is a big question, is how do we govern arts and culture moving forward? And one of the things that we'll be talking about as we move into implementation. But that said, one of the strengths is that because there are so many stakeholder groups that have participated, each different group is looking at ways they can use these recommendations to inform their work, their strategies, and their future planning. So it really is intended as a document that can be used at the government level, at the business level, for individual artists and creatives and nonprofits.
Yeah, so March is about the time the Park City Council begins its budget process. Will you be making any funding requests, or do you even know what those could be?
Well, we're going to have a couple of different presentations to council about this process in March. I think right now we're on the docket for March 8th, and then again at the end of March to kind of celebrate the conclusion or the closing phase of the planning process. Interestingly, the county's grant process also happens in March. So March is a big time for nonprofit arts and culture organizations. I think that a lot of the recommendations are far-reaching and will take a number of years to implement. So it's really looking at what can we do quickly and then what can we do over the years to really ensure, you know, vitality and continued sustainability.
Yeah, at one point, I mean, there was hope for arts and culture to get more of the RAP tax that divide had been shifted at some point. I mean, is that still a push to get it back to the 50-50 split?
You know, one of the recommendations is really to look at the current sources of public funding and to understand, you know, how they are disseminated now and where there are future opportunities for arts and culture funding at the public level. So obviously, there's the RAP and restaurant tax streams now, and there'll be a need to reauthorize those. They have to be reauthorized every 10 years, so there'll be a process process of looking at all of that through the reauthorization process. I know there have been many conversations here and around the community about the new TRT agreement that the chamber and the county have, and I think there'll be some ongoing conversations about how arts and culture can be part of that pool of funding potentially moving forward.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
I think that this is really a community-driven effort, so to the extent that people can come out and engage with us and learn what we've done, we'd love to see you at these open houses. And the Project ABC Pledge is a digital high five, and that's on the home page of the website. So if you haven't taken that already, it's a really great free way to show your support for arts and culture in our community.
Okay. So just to recap, this Tuesday, February 27th, you'll be at the Colville Library, 5 to 7 p.m. And then the following week, Tuesday, March 6th, 5 to 7 p.m., hopefully at the County Services Building. We'll update that if we need to. And then that Thursday, March 8th, at the Park City Library again, 5 to 7 p.m.
That's right. Thank you so much.
Okay. Hadley, thanks for stopping by. And with this final report from Pyeongchang, South Korea, Tom Kelly with the U.S. Ski and Snowboard. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Leslie. We're in the home stretch now.
Yeah. So just final two days left of competition here. Let's talk about what's kind of just happened with Super Thursday.
Well, before we get into that, just one breaking news item that folks may have seen this morning was just announced on the Today Show, is that Team USA has, the athletes of Team USA have selected their flag bearer for the closing ceremony on Sunday, and it is none other than Olympic champion Jessie Diggins. She won that honor over nominees from all of the sports in an election that was concluded on Friday afternoon. So a great honor for her. This honor was also bestowed to a skier in 2010 in Vancouver. And that time it was Billy DeMong, who lives in Park City now, who had the honor of carrying the flag. But amazing opportunity for Jessie Diggins, and she announced that on a live Today Show appearance just a few hours ago. So a great way to, a little something to look forward to as we wrap up these games.
Okay. So, again, taking a look at Super Thursday, where we had just a bunch of events coming to head there.
Yeah, it was a pretty amazing day. And if folks remember 2 days ago, we reported on that remarkable win with the gold medal for Jessie Diggins and Keegan Randall in the team sprint cross country, first time ever. And also that day, Lindsey Vonn picking up a bronze medal in the women's downhill. Super Thursday, we just absolutely packed with competition. Jamie Anderson kicked it off, winning a silver in big air snowboarding, first time ever for that event. Austria's Anna Gasser picking up the gold there. And David Wise, on his third and final try, was able to put down a remarkable run in the men's halfpipe skiing event. He took the gold. Alex Ferreira of the Team USA picking up the silver. Everybody was pulling for Torin Yeader Wallace. He had a gold medal run, but he just could not quite land it. So gold and silver for the USA in the men's halfpipe competition. So all in all, a pretty remarkable day. Seven athlete medals in 28 hours on Wednesday and Thursday.
Okay, Michaela Schifrin getting her second medal of the games.
Yeah, it was exciting for her. Definitely in the gold medal hunt, as was Lindsey Vonn. A great downhill for her. A little bit sharper even than she showed in the special downhill a day earlier. Michaela Schifrin coming away with both a gold in the giant slalom and a silver in the alpine combined.
Okay, and now do we have a Team USA alpine competition coming up?
We do. Coming up this weekend, final events, most of them on Saturday. It's going to kick off with men's big air snowboarding for sure. This is a medal opportunity for the USA. Red Girard, Chris Corning, and Kyle Mack going. They all made it through to qualifying, first time ever event. It's interesting what they've done here. They have built the big air scaffold in the ski jumping stadium, and it kind of is opposite of the ski jump by landing in the same general finish area. So that kicks it off. Then we go to the alpine team event. At the same time, we have snowboarding parallel giant slalom going in Phoenix Park, and wrap it up with the men's 50K classic cross country on Saturday, and the final event of the Olympic Games, the women's 30K cross country. Jessie Diggins going for a medal again. She has been no lower than sixth place in any of the events so far here in this Games.
Is that a freestyle event or a classic event? Ski.
This is a classic event this year. So it's not necessarily her forte, but she's in a pretty good spirit with it right now and looking forward to it. She's also been very, very busy with the media appearances, and it was interesting with the flag bearer announcement. We had that news broken to her at about 5 o'clock today, and she was pretty well wrapped for the day. When she heard that news, she said, yeah, I am just so deeply honored, and I would be happy to come back and go on the Today Show later tonight. And she did that, and honored to see her as flag bearer Sunday evening as these games come to a close in Pyeongchang.
Okay, and who's going to be on the Alpine team? Do we have both men's and women's?
It's a mixed gender event, and this takes place tomorrow. And let me get you the names here on that. Hopefully I've got them here for you. This is a six-man team, and that team is going to include David Sharansky, Mark Engel, and Nolan Casper on the men's side, and for the women, Park City's own Megan McJames, Trisha Mangan, and Alice Merriweather. That's going to kick off at 7 o'clock tonight, Park City time, so you can watch that live on NBC.
Okay, we had hoped, I think, Ted Ligety was going to be in that. Did he decide not to?
Ted, he really never considered this, and he actually has left Pyeongchang. So, no, he... You know, it's an event that many of the top athletes have not really been that motivated to participate in. Lindsay talked a little bit about this today at our press conference, but no, Ted had not really looked at that as an opportunity for himself.
Okay. So you'll be in studio with us on Monday?
I will be in studio on Monday to wrap things up. It has been a great Olympics here in Pyeongchang. I think what we'll take away from these Olympics are, first of all, amazingly world-class venues in every event we have competed in. We have had absolutely the best venues. You do not always get that in Olympics, but, boy, we had great venues here. The friendliness of the Korean people, we have felt very, very welcomed here right from the start. And we brought a competitive team here, and it's been fascinating to see how competitive we were in many sports where we have not been in the past. And producing some historic gold medals over the course of the last couple of weeks, 8 athletes so far winning gold medals, and hopefully another one coming up in big air snowboarding on Saturday morning.
Okay, Tom, we'll see you then. Thanks for your time.
Great. Thanks for everybody in Park City for tuning in, and we'll see you Monday.
Nasir Marouche, a local doctor and director of CARMA, the Comprehensive Arrhythmia Research and Management Center at the University of Utah, was recently honored by having his research published in the New England School of Medicine. He joins me now in the studio. Good morning and congratulations.
Thank you, Leslie, for having me.
Yeah, so what does it mean for a doctor to have his or her research published in this journal?
Obviously, that's not only for the doctor, but for the people we treat. That's a big, big, big deal because papers published in the New England Journal of Medicine are usually guidelines-changing papers. The impact of the message through the journal and the scrutiny the research goes through to get published in that journal is extremely high, and to practically making change and impact in patient care and medicine, that important to publish in New England Journal of Medicine.
Yeah, well, I was reading about it, and it says it's the oldest continuously published medical journal, and this is the place that back in the 1840s that the breakthrough in surgical anesthesia was first reported, inhaled ether. Hard to believe that just 175 years ago we did surgery without any anesthetic. But I've kind of heard it's like winning the Oscar. I mean, is that an appropriate metaphor?
You know, it's for us. The feeling is the same. The feelings at the Oscars. Yes, I'd compare it to that. But as important is the impact of New England Journal of Medicine on the patients, because all patients as well read New England Journal of Medicine, and not only scientists and physicians, and that's why through that journal to communicate to that amount of people with that important message, just like one we just published, it was very important. So yes, you can compare it to the Oscars if you want to.
So this is something that non-medical people would read, huh?
Mm-hmm. Actually, in fact, the moment the embargo was lifted, the first email I get from my patient, who is a entrepreneur and then looks into the world in medicine, and the first thing is, congratulations, I just saw your paper in New England Journal of Medicine. Thank you for treating me with that treatment, and now I know I'm living longer.
Yeah. Now, is it something that doctors would submit to the journal for consideration, or do they actually kind of search you out?
Usually we send, hundreds of publications we publish, we usually send and wait for a response with the reviewers to come with our papers. In this case, the paper was presented already in late-breaking trials. So when you have a very important data that will change patient care. You tend to put this paper in a big meeting to look at the biggest collection of where the physicians come together. And then this was in a European Society of Cardiology meeting in Barcelona last August, where there was 35,000 cardiologists. So we submitted that, we asked them if we want to present that study, and then New England Journal saw that we are on the podium before we even submitted the paper, and then sent us an invitation to submit the paper to them, because obviously they understood the importance of this message highlighted in this paper.
Yeah, had you submitted something prior to this?
You know, I submitted a lot of papers in my career. I mean, I published more than 150 articles in my career so far, and that's a process. You submit your work, and people accept it. You move on, but in this case, obviously, we would have submitted the paper after the presentation, but they invited us in the moment they heard about it in order for us not to go to other journal practically. So they were very interested in us publishing this paper in New England Journal of Medicine.
Yeah, and it was interesting to see. I mean, so you're kind of the lead on it. There are a number of other people also listed that did the research. And
you know, it's always a group of people. It's never one person, as you know. And we were lucky. And we continue to be lucky. We had a great group of people, investigators from more than 30 centers worldwide, Australia, Europe, and the United States, and that participated in the study, which is, by the way, called the CASEL-AF study. And all these people listed are investigators or co-investigators with us or co-lead with us on this study. So, yes, everybody participated, and the importance of this study and why this is important. You see all these names to explain to the world that this doesn't apply only in the U.S. or Europe or Australia, but everywhere else. So that it's a global study. And it took place, as I said before, in 33 hospitals in the world with their recruited patients. That's why you see all these names on the.
And I also noted that it was, you have to list all of the drug manufacturers. Is that just so that there's no?
You have to be transparent. I mean, you have to be transparent, and we are. I mean, not only the University of Utah, where I work, mandates that, but the journal itself. So they want to be sure that there's no, you know, a conflict that you're doing this with full transparency, and that's why I push everybody and the journals as well to us to disclose these relationships.
Right. So without
and the support, actually, of this. So this study, for example, was supported by industry, a major industry partner, a company called Biotronic, which helps us with funding the study. Obviously, it's very highly costly, and then we thank them for that.
Yeah, and that's something the university, I think, has been very successful at, right? Getting that those
They're
grant
very,
funds.
Yeah, exactly. The University of Utah has been supporting us in getting grants from NIH, American Heart, any kind of national governmental institution, and industry funding as well. Their partnerships with industry has been phenomenal at the university over the years.
So without getting too wonky and technical, can you explain what the article is about?
So the studies, the acronym is CASEL-AF, which is this is the first time ever we could prove in a study, it took us 9 years to finish, that catheter ablation of atrial fibrillation, practically an invasive treatment of atrial fibrillation, is superior to medical treatment, meaning drugs or medication that people usually take, conventional treatment. In saving lives, very important, in saving lives, I repeat that 3 times, in saving lives and keeping people away from the hospital. So the study looked at, you know, took two group of patients, took patients with atrial fibrillation and who are suffering from heart failure, which is a lot of people in America and the world as well. I mean, you have more than, 5 to 6 million heart failure people diagnosed with heart failure and probably around 25 million, which is pre-heart failure stage. And third of those have atrial fibrillation. So this population, we looked at the sick population, and we offered them 2 treatments. One group was treated with the catheter ablation. You put the catheter into the heart, and you ablate certain areas to suppress atrial fibrillation. The treatment has been going on for 18 years, by the way, versus conventional treatment. When you go to your primary care physician today or your cardiologist, they usually put you on drugs because people did not believe until now, until you have symptoms, that if you ablate, you save lives. So that's why should we do it? Let's give them drugs and medicine. So we started a study 9 years ago where we, you know, put these two groups together, and then this last February, the data was, you know, the study was finished, and we looked at the end results, and we showed that we were saving lives by the ablation in more than 47% risk reduction. And more, I mean, if you cut the risk of death doing an ablation by almost half, 50%, imagine. And we the same thing for keeping people out of the hospital. So we could lower your risk of, as a patient, going to the hospital by almost 46% or almost 50%. So not only we improved mortality, but we kept people away from the hospital by ablating them. So that was important. I mean, I expected, obviously, you put a study together because you're doing a treatment to a patient, which you believe in, and that's what you should do as a treating physician. But we were treating patients until then based on, you know, you have symptoms, let me do an ablation and elevate the symptoms. So we never had solid data. We call it hard endpoint data in related to ablation until now. That's why the impact of this study is so huge. So practically now, if a patient have atrial fibrillation, that's the conclusion of the study, you should get ablated first before you even try any single drug. If you have a heart failure and atrial fibrillation, I think this is highly recommended. That was the conclusion of the study. So we saved lives, and we kept people away from the hospital. And you can imagine the impact on cost as well, maybe keeping people away from the hospital. So huge.
So it's a surgical procedure that can be done in outpatient, or
it depends on hospital you go to, outpatient overnight stay. But it's in we don't use the word surgical. We call it invasive because we put the catheters into the heart and through the veins, through the vessels, and we pull them out and then we put pressure on the groin, and that's it. So it's not really surgical. It's invasive procedure, but not surgical procedure.
All right. So when we talk about arrhythmia and AFib, I mean, are they the same thing?
No, they're not. We have, arrhythmia is any time your heart is not conducting right. You have an extra beat, that's arrhythmia. You have multiple kinds of arrhythmia from every chamber in the heart. We have four chambers. There's arrhythmias based on where they come from and originated. But AFib is the most common arrhythmia worldwide and the most common arrhythmia we deal with because it affects more than, depends on the statistics you look at, but in America alone, we have around 6 to 8 million people suffering from atrial fibrillation. And honestly, until now, you can treat them any way you want. Give them drugs if you don't have an ablation capabilities, or ablate them if you have ablation capabilities. But now with this study, we have more, strong push and support to do the ablation as first-line therapy in this patient population we described.
So do we know what causes this, or is it something you're born with? Or
The last 11 years, and one of the reasons why I came to Utah is to understand the physiology of our hearts causing the arrhythmias. And what we defined in the last 11 years in Utah, we were still working on this, is that you have a scarring in your heart. You have something called fibrosis, which seems to harbor and maintain atrial fibrillation before the AFib even comes. And that's what we're studying, trying to prevent it. What causes this is, unfortunately, when I got this, that's a Nobel Prize and that's an Oscar probably as well. We don't know yet. It's multifactorial. We know that high blood pressure is very associated with atrial fibrillation, heart failure as in this population, valvular disease, thyroid disease, coronary artery disease or heart attacks could cause this. So to mention some, diabetes is a big cause of atrial fibrillation. So it's genetic, last but not least. We see this a lot in our practice of families with AFib generation after generation. And unfortunately, the risk of AFib when patients come to see us, a recent study from our center, follows you five generations from your parents goes on to their children over time. So screening is important to know that as well. So that's why we don't know yet what causes it. We know that what contributes to starting, but we think the scarring in the heart is crucial, and that's what we've been focusing on, trying to prevent it and early detect it in Utah. We always learn.
Well, again, congratulations on the honor with the publication. Thanks
for
your time,
Leslie.
This morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
And I should just note that today and tomorrow, Marouche will be hosting upwards of 500 cardiologists, scientists, students, and entrepreneurs all interested about AFib at the DoubleTree here in Park City. They come from all over the world, including Australia, Asia, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and South America. You can follow along on social media at Western AF.